The People's Epic!
My image is like kind of granola girl meets business savvy.
Granola girl meets business savvy.
I texted, this is the truest thing I've ever heard about I've ever said about myself. I texted Christina and we were going to meet up and with our dogs. I was like, yeah, let's go to Fetch and we'll just like let the dogs play and then we'll go for a walk because she's a mimosa mom and she's a granola mom. And I think that is so true because I can definitely sit and relax and, you know, kind of let the fur kids play. And then I'm going to get up and play with them and, you know, go for a hike.
I wonder how recent of a thing that is where people categorize themselves by certain things that they do or eat, you know?
I think that's probably pretty old.
Like, I'm a hamburger guy.
Yeah.
Love a hamburger.
Yeah. I'm sure there were, you know, women thousands of years ago who said, yeah, I really like men's butts.
Like, I'm a butt girl.
I'm a butt girl. And other women said, oh, no, I'm a brawn girl or, you know.
Yeah, I get that. Girl. I totally understand that.
I think that when we were cave women, we were classifying ourselves as that.
I'm a wooden club gal.
I'm a wooden club gal. Oh, Jesus.
Yeah.
Oh, no. I don't know. That could get dangerous.
Oh, yeah. Sure.
Big fan of a guy that can swing a stick.
Also, going back a little bit. Why do we call it a hamburger when it's made out of beef?
That's a great question. Do you want me to find out? I actually really want to know.
Sure. Why don't we, take a second and figure that one out.
Oh, okay. The name hamburger comes from the seaport town of Hamburg, Germany.
I think I knew that.
Thought that the idea of raw shredded beef turned into a patty came about, I guess.
Well, how about that?
Yeah.
The burger comes from Hamburg.
Hamburg, Germany.
That's awesome.
The very American hamburger
comes from Germany.
German, and the fries with which we eat the hamburger are French.
Yeah.
Yeah.
How about that? If that's not melting pot of America, I don't know what is.
Indeed, we are a melting pot. We like to forget it and ignore it sometimes.
All the time.
We stole everything.
Yeah. That's so funny. Well, hey, adventurers. I hope you learned something leaning into that one. I honestly was curious. I had always thought about that, why we call the hamburger when there's only it's made of beef. Now we know.
I'll also never not think about the Pink Panther with Steve Martin when he's like, I want to buy a hamburger.
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 The burger.
Oh, it's so good. He's so good.
Yeah, he's so good. We do need to finish Only Murders in the Building.
We do.
Anyways, thanks for joining us again, guys. Happy Monday.
Happy Monday.
Hope you guys enjoyed the last episode. It was our first interview ever on our show, and we had a great time talking about our friend and learning about our friend Kimber.
Yeah, she's so young, and she's lived so much life. She's fought so many things and overcome so many like inner struggles, and I just have always been so impressed by her determination and will to literally walk across the earth thousands and thousands of miles.
Yeah.
It's incredible.
It's really awesome, and her story, I hope, inspires some folks out there to get out and go see the world and hike a mountain.
Yeah, if you're thinking about through hiking, there are a lot of really great resources online to help you prepare. Lots of training regimens and also really good Facebook groups for that kind of stuff.
Totally. That impulse to get out there and try it has grown a little stronger since then.
Yeah.
It's always been there, but if Kimber can do it, people can do it. Yeah. We can all do it. Let's all hike the AT and PCT together.
Here we go. Leave no trace.
What was that trivia question at the end of the episode?
Yes. The trivia question at the end of the episode was, who hiked the longest through hike ever?
That's right. And I think I didn't have an answer, but I thought I was asking if it was like on the AT, but it's probably longer than that.
It was not the AT. It was the Trans-Canada Trail. I don't remember if I asked the question that way of who hiked it or what was the longest trail, because I really just found out.
I believe you asked who had the longest through hike.
Through hike, yeah.
Yeah.
Canadian-born Sarah Jackson wrapped up one of the longest through hikes on an 11,500-kilometer route through the Trans-Canadian Trail.
Wow.
11,500 kilometers.
That's crazy. What is that in mileage for all the American listeners out there?
That is 7,146 miles.
Woohoo!
7,000 miles.
Jeez.
Across Canada.
Louise.
It took her 2 years from Vancouver Island to St. John's on Newfoundland. So, I mean, literally, she went straight east.
Wow.
Yeah, it's incredible.
That's amazing.
Yeah, like I can't even imagine just being out there that long.
Sarah, what's her last name?
Jackson.
Sarah Jackson. Mm-hmm. Shout out to Sarah Jackson.
Shout out to Sarah.
That's very impressive. I wonder how what she did for... I mean, I guess if you're through hiking like that, if you save up maybe $5,000, $10,000, mm-hmm. you could probably make a solid through hike, right? For that much money?
Yeah, you probably could. You could probably also get like make a little money along the way, like helping people out with like different things.
True.
I mean, yeah. She did it for 2 years. You
be
know,
like I'm a sure taskmaster. Yeah, just stopped do, like, off some... and did some stuff.
Helpful things. And I would imagine that a lot of, I mean, so I hear when you're through hiking, you also kind of live off of people's generosity and people who are trail magic. They offer like, you know,
that's
food
right, yeah.
and places to stay.
Oh man, we didn't ask Kimber about trail magic.
We didn't. And that was a mistake. We should definitely ask her about trail magic.
Well, when we get her back on, which we will at some point, I definitely want to talk to her about trail magic.
She has some really fun stories about trail magic.
I would love that for sure.
Yeah.
Well, that's incredible.
Yeah.
Well, before we jump in, you have the next adventurer
that
we're talking about. Do you want to tee us up?
Yeah, I will. So I have quite a tee up for this one, actually. This is someone that I have wanted to talk about for a while. I did a movie last year, and this person is in that movie. Someone plays this person in the movie because he lived about 120 years ago, or was born about 120 years ago. He's an amazing human and someone that I want the whole world to know. I think Americans, like we all know of Martin Luther King, like he was this incredible civil rights leader. And there are people like that around the world in other countries, mm-hmm. Contemporaries of Martin Luther King's that we need to know of. So
great.
He is very much reminiscent of that.
Interesting. I think I know who you're going to talk about.
I think you do too.
Well, let's hop in.
Dr. Ambedkar.
Dr. Ambedkar.
Dr. Ambedkar.
Yeah. Do you want to explain how this came about?
Yeah. So Dr. Ambedkar was a leader, a jurist, a social reformer, and the chief architect of the Indian Constitution. He basically changed the lives for what was previously known as the untouchable caste in India, mm-hmm. Now referred to as the Dalits. And just an incredibly smart man. He himself was born into the untouchable caste mm-hmm. and got a great education, fought for his education, left the country and came back and left it a better place than he found it. So I'm in a movie called Origin, directed by Ava DuVernay. And in that movie, it talks about casteism throughout the world, social hierarchies that are constructed, and one of which is the caste system in India. And so in that movie, it talks about his life. And I'm so grateful to that movie for exposing me to this incredible person. And so I wanted to do an episode dedicated to him. I'm excited to tell you all about his life.
Yeah, that Origin did a really great job of showcasing mm-hmm. His importance in that film. And just his story. But I'm excited to dive in a little deeper.
Born on April 14th, 1891, in Madhya Pradesh to a Mahar or untouchable family. He was the 14th and last child. He was 14th. Ooh. Yeah. I can't imagine having that many siblings.
No, man. Yeah.
And also being born to such a poor family.
As an untouchable, yeah.
He was allowed to attend school, but he was treated lesser by other students and the teachers. He had to sit on a burlap sack in the back of the room and couldn't touch any of the water fountains, let alone any of the other students. The way he got water, the water would be poured to him, like, you know, when you waterfall water, mm-hmm. like from your water bottle, to him by the school peon, who was like a work for hire laborer. Yeah. And just as a kid to like grow up and be so put down.
And to visibly see regularly that you are different.
Yeah.
Or that you have been marked as different,
therefore.
Yeah, I can't imagine the psychology, like what that does to a kid.
Yeah. And it happens all across the world because we have these social hierarchies that unfortunately kids suffer from and then adults suffer from as well.
Yeah.
But yeah, it breaks my heart to think about like just the really terrible things that adults construct that then children have to suffer from. And yes, also other adults do too. But anyway.
We'll dive into that.
We will.
Let's get to him. It's
a theme.
Yeah.
Ambedkar overcame immense social discrimination and became a very prominent figure in Indian history and made some really lasting progressive effects on his home country. Despite the social ostracization he faced, he was determined to pursue his education. He became the only untouchable enrolled at Elphinstone High School and later passed his qualifying exam and matriculated to Elphinstone College, which was affiliated with the University of Bombay.
Mm.
He became, according to him and some historians that have written about him, the first from his caste to do so.
That's incredible.
To graduate from the University of Bombay. He got married very young. This is a common practice in India and has been for a long time. It was an arranged marriage, but a happy one by all accounts.
Okay.
But they were really young. I think he was 16 and she was 10.
Oh, boy.
Different time.
But totally.
Very different time.
That's still wild, though.
Yeah, very wild. But they were married for a very long time, had several children.
Yeah.
And he very much so loved her. There's a lot of letters that he wrote to her. Bimrao earned his degree from the University of Bombay, as I said, and in 1913, at 22, he was rewarded a scholarship for 3 years to move to the United States and attend Columbia University in New York.
Okay.
While he was there, he wrote papers about democracy, social inequality, and the caste system. Many years later, he would also receive his PhD in economics at Columbia as well.
And what year was this, roughly?
So it was 1913 when he went to Columbia for the first time, and then 1927 when he got his PhD in economics.
Wow.
He was a lifelong student.
Totally. Yeah, sounds like it.
Yeah.
I mean, the pursuit, that takes so much, and I'm sure we'll get into this a little deeper too, but that takes so much tenacity to climb that.
Yeah. Dedication to your education.
Totally.
Yeah.
Very impressive. Very, very impressive.
Absolutely. And to leave his family too, and to leave his home country and be in a place that was so shockingly different. I mean, this was 1913 before there was really any exposure, you know, internet, like, I mean, I'm sure there are pictures, books, things like that to prepare him, but.
Yeah. And civil rights laws were still.
Yes.
In the mix too.
1913, women couldn't vote yet.
Yeah.
Right.
That's crazy.
In 1916, he enrolled for the bar course at Gray's Inn to become a lawyer. And at the same time, he enrolled at the London School of Economics, where he started working on his doctoral thesis. His scholarship ended around this time, so he actually had to go back to India. And this was a really crazy story, and kind of to your point about putting his life in context of the world. So he had to go back to India because his scholarship ended. So he put his book collection, it was a big book collector. We're going to talk about how many books he had in a while later on. But big book collector, he put his book collection on a ship. And he himself traveled home on a different ship. Wildly, the ship that held his books was torpedoed and sunk by a German submarine.
Oh my gosh. That would piss me off so bad.
Piss you off, but also, holy shit that you got on the right boat.
Yeah, real
talk. And not the wrong one.
Yeah.
But so yeah, to put his life in context, he was living and studying during World War I. And then World War II as well.
Right.
Yeah.
Studying through all of that.
Yeah.
Man. Those coincidences like that in history and just in life in general are always so, like, you can't help but feel some sort of mysticism when that kind of thing happens. It's like, this guy was, without him, we wouldn't have had the same push for civil rights in India.
Yeah.
And if he had been on that boat, bye.
Yeah, and all of the...
I mean, maybe he could have survived, but it would have been way more difficult.
Torpedoed, though, in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean. Like, I mean, yeah, like very...
His chances of survival dropped very low. Significantly.
But no, I mean, to your point, like that one life can have such an effect on so many.
Yeah.
If he had gotten on the wrong boat, so many lives would have suffered for much longer. Now, unfortunately, they still do suffer. There is still inequality in the country, they still are treated very poorly. But that is the reason why we need to talk about him, and we need to talk about the caste system so that they can be changed. But yeah, to put his life in context of what happened, wow. Thankfully, he survived. So he made it back to India, and then he did end up finishing his master's degree at the London School of Economics. And then, like I said, he went back to, or sorry, he got so many degrees. So he got a master's degree in 1921 at the London School of Economics. 2 years later, he got his DSc in economics, which was awarded from the University of London. And then the same year, he was called to the bar by Gray's Inn. So he became a lawyer.
Dang.
Yeah.
Workhorse.
Workhorse for sure, over several years. And then sort of things just started hitting and he started jumping into the workforce.
Yeah.
During his time back in India, he did become involved socially and politically. So this was, let's see, 1920. So he would have been about 30. He established a group that worked towards socioeconomic improvement for the untouchable caste. And he dedicated his life to, like I mentioned, you know, eradicating the caste system and this horrible discrimination that was happening. He also encouraged his followers to embrace Buddhism. As a means to escape the shackles of caste hierarchy. So the caste system is built, India, the main religion is Hinduism. Mm-hmm. And he encouraged his followers to embrace Buddhism, which preaches very
open
counter to that.
And, yeah.
Well, equality. Yeah. And all are created equal and the spirit inside each other and seeing each other. Hinduism reinforces that there are levels of being. So he began to embrace Buddhism, began to preach Buddhism and Buddhist beliefs. In 1932, he fought and won for the scheduled castes, i.e. the untouchables, to have seats in legislative bodies, which was a huge improvement for them to actually be able to vote and have a presence in those bodies. In 1936, he wrote and delivered this very famous speech called The Annihilation of Caste in Lahore, which critiqued the caste system. It eventually became a book. I actually have heard of that before. I actually remember I had a social studies teacher who talked about that book and like recommended we all read it. I don't think I actually did, but I kind of want to now. But basically it just, you know, preached all that we're talking about, his beliefs that like people, there should not be a caste system. We should not have these social hierarchies. Like also like we have in America, like there should be equality and
Delegates from the untouchables section, quote unquote, of the caste system, they were speaking on behalf of the entire system or just solely for the voices of the untouchables?
So Dr. Ambedkar made his speech, The Annihilation of Caste.
Right.
But
You said that there was a society that he had basically started that put some people into lines of authority in order to speak on behalf to like the greater populace.
So he did create a group that fought for the rights of Dalits, yes. And then in 1932, he did win seats in the legislative bodies for Dalits. Yes.
Right, right. I think my question was, were they speaking on behalf of just the Dalits or were they speaking on behalf of like the entire government or like the
all of different castes?
Yeah.
Well, the other castes were already represented. The untouchables were the only group that hadn't been represented in the legislative bodies yet.
Okay, so this wasn't like a merger of like all peoples of India. These were just people that they finally had a voice for the Dalits.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
They finally had a voice in their ruling bodies to affect social policy, which obviously affects
them. I don't think my question made sense as I was saying it out loud. It made more sense in my head.
You're good. But the important thing is that they can now speak in those bodies and have a seat at the table. It's always, you know, you want to be in the room where it happens, right?
For sure.
You want to affect, social change and policy, which affects all people. So his speech and book, Annihilation of Caste, strongly criticized Hindu orthodox religious leaders and the caste system in general. It also included a rebuke of Gandhi. Honestly, I don't want to get too far down a rabbit hole, go on a rabbit hole about Gandhi for sure. Because Gandhi did reinforce the caste system, and that is the darker side of what he did. And again, that's a different episode for a different time.
There's a whole lot to unpack there.
Yeah. It was weird, though, because Ambedkar talked about in a BBC interview in the 50s, he accused Gandhi of writing in opposition of the caste system in English. Whenever he was writing in English papers, Gandhi would write in opposition of it. But when he wrote in the Gujarati language papers of India, he would be in support of it. So Gandhi actually kind of flip-flopped depending
contrarian.
On who his audience was. Very contrarian, yeah. In 1935, Dr. Ambedkar settled in Bombay, which is present-day Mumbai. overseeing the construction of his house, where he stocked his personal library of, guess how many books he had? In the 30s. How many books he had in the 30s? We'll give it like just the context of like printing books in the 30s and stuff like that.
Oh, okay. I'm going to say, are we talking in the hundreds? I'm going to give it higher. 1,500?
Books?
Yeah.
50,000.
Jesus!
Yeah.
Why?
His personal library, he had more than 50,000 books.
That is... Dude, I mean...
He was ridiculously smart.
I can't imagine so well read. Books around.
I know, right?
I'm thinking now of like simple home life, you know, moving things.
Yeah.
Books are always the hardest part.
Yeah.
Or one of the hardest parts. And then to have 50,000 of them traveling with you.
Yeah. Well, no, but also remember his whole book collection had
sank.
Been destroyed, had been torpedoed. So this was 50,000 books that he had gotten since his like early 20s.
I can't imagine. Yeah. That's incredible.
Crazy. Absolutely crazy. I like picture in my head like a Beauty and the Beast, you know, library full of like just thousands of books, but 50,000.
I don't even think some public libraries have that many books.
No, I'm sure they don't. Crazy. In 1942, Dr. Ambedkar supported the Quit India movement against British colonial rule. And in 1947, a few years later, he was appointed the chairman of the drafting committee of the Constituent Assembly. Basically, he led the framing of the Indian Constitution. So this is sort of the big moment. All mm-hmm. of his life has really led to this huge thing that he got to do, which was frame the Indian Constitution. The Constitution was adopted in 1950. As the chairman of the drafting committee, he played a pivotal role in shaping what was written inside of the Constitution. He emphasized social justice, equality, and fundamental rights, laying the groundwork for a democratic and inclusive nation. Again, like if it had been anybody else, you know, you never know the direction of history if it hadn't been this man who cared mm-hmm. so deeply about the equality of people and had experienced it so viscerally himself.
Yeah.
You know?
Totally.
His vision for a society free from discrimination is reflected in the constitutional provisions that aim to uplift socially and economically disadvantaged people. One of the biggest movements he made was in 1951, so this is a year after the Constitution was adopted. Along with thousands of followers, he converted to Buddhism, renouncing Hinduism to protest the caste discrimination. So him and, thousands of people all together converted to Buddhism on October 14th.
So, but he had been preaching about Buddhism for a while. Yes. He just never made the transition.
Yeah, I couldn't figure out why that was or couldn't find why that was. It seemed like, and this is totally possible, that maybe he followed Buddhism in private or sort of like he adhered to the rules, but he didn't like publicly convert. Like, you know, when you're like baptized, like maybe you've believed in, you know, God or whatever sure. for a while, but then it's like a public declaration.
Well, you had a bigger platform now. So,
yeah,
it would make more of an impact on the pedestal he was atop of.
Yes, and actually this is dawning on me too. I wonder if he felt safer to do so and to do this big public declaration now that the new constitution had been passed.
Probably. I don't imagine there's religious zealots everywhere, but I'd imagine the opposition, I mean, I don't know, maybe they had a stronger opinion now, but I feel like he was riding the courage of this moment for
sure.
his people.
Yeah.
That to protest something like that.
Yeah.
It would have just been the better way to do it.
Yeah. I mean, you have to be so strategic about moves like that because it's like the climate has to be right.
Mm-hmm.
You have to be safe. I mean, he had several children. So his wife had unfortunately passed away a few years before this, but then he got remarried. So he had a new wife and he had a family to protect
yeah.
from the people who are in opposition to you, of which there are many.
Mm-hmm.
There were many and there are many. In the movie, in Origin, they talk about how there are statues of Dr. Ambedkar all over the country.
Mm-hmm.
But those statues are actually inside of metal cages.
Right.
Because people will vandalize the statues if they aren't protected.
Yeah.
So, like, imagine, again, like, you know, to compare him to Martin Luther King, who this is a very, like, equal comparison. If the statues of Martin Luther King were, like, inside of metal cages to protect them from vandals.
Yeah.
Because there are unfortunately racist
people
in this country.
There.
Yeah. Right. And so, yeah. So he obviously existed in a very tension filled climate. So doing that, you know, mass conversion of all of his followers and himself, I think he probably had to just be really calculated about it. since 1948, so a couple of years before he had written the Constitution or helped to write the Constitution, he was not the only one. Dr. Ambedkar had diabetes, so he had to take care of his health or be more intentional about his health. Unfortunately, he remained in bed for most of 1954. So like he had diabetes for about 6 years and then it kind of got really bad. Mm. And in 1954, he became bedridden because of some medication side effects and really bad eyesight.
Oh, man. Yeah.
Yeah. His health got pretty bad in 1955. So he was like still working and he would do a lot of interviews and a lot of correspondence, but he really didn't get to go anywhere. 3 days after completing his final manuscript, The Buddha and His Dhamma, Ambedkar died in his sleep on December 6, 1956, in his home in Delhi. So he finishes his manuscript. Like, how cinematic is this? Mm-hmm. He finishes his manuscript all about the Buddha and his Dharma and like these beautiful equality-inspired spiritual beliefs of how good people are and seeing the good in others. And then he like passes away 3 days later.
So my work here is done.
Yeah.
But to Jesus, I mean, he did so much in the time he was given.
Yes, he very much so did.
But yeah, to your point, that's incredibly poetic. You finish this treatise on how to live life as a well-rounded
Buddhist,
loving person,
Indian rebel.
Yeah,
totally was a rebel.
Yeah.
And then
so was the Buddha.
Yeah. Yeah. You know? Absolutely. A Buddhist cremation was organized at Dadar Chaupati Beach on December 7th. Attended by 500,000 grieving people.
Wow.
A conversion program was organized a few days later so that cremation attendees were also converted to Buddhism at the same place.
Wow.
If they chose to.
Yeah. That's so much work and so much studying. That's so much initiation in your mm-hmm. in the well-being of other people.
Yeah. And he lived, I mean, not even 60 years.
Yeah.
You know, like that's, you have a lasting effect for hundreds of years in the work that you do, or he has a lasting effect for hundreds of years on the work that he did within his 60 years of life. And I just, there's something so incredibly beautiful and powerful to see someone who comes up from literally nothing.
Yeah.
And achieves their dreams, sure. But then add the layer onto that he now opened the door for millions of people to achieve their dreams and yeah. to rise above their station and to really fight the power. I mean, this man had a lot of fire inside of him and a lot of empathy as well.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah.
You could tell for sure.
Yeah.
I think my biggest question then is like, the caste system is still there.
It is.
So he didn't get rid of it.
No. It is not completely demolished. It has been a very deep-seated, long-held system mm-hmm. for a very long time. And I would say just like racism in America, It has been around for a very long time, and India is older than America.
Yeah.
It is hard to change those systems of belief, but we can do it.
Yeah,
and
totally.
His step in the right direction, and even our steps in the right direction, to get literally like, you know, people in those legislative bodies that can represent.
Well, people that have been classified as a certain X. I don't think I just hate that there is not a. There doesn't seem to be a clear answer to like getting rid of it. I mean, just stop. But also like there's, to your point earlier, there's centuries of people that have lived this way. Mm-hmm. I'd imagine nowadays there's few forward Dalits. I would hope, you know, like the caste system has definitely, I would hope, gotten smaller.
Well, I think there's not as many, there's definitely no limitations legally, you know?
Yeah.
There's socially, sure, and like in remote parts of the country and things that, yeah, I mean, I think the biggest thing that I would like to do in this conversation is shine a light on it and then encourage people to do their own research and also to challenge the system. If there is a system of social hierarchy or a system of oppression that you notice, challenge it.
Yeah.
And you can do so really politically and respectfully, or maybe strategically is maybe the word to use. But I think that knowing of Dr. Ambedkar's life, knowing of the work that he did, talking about him will inspire, you know, our current generations to continue that work. There's a really beautiful museum about his work and his life that is in the shape of a book, of an open book.
Oh, yeah.
I remember the guy in the movie kind of jokes that it's an open book concept.
Yeah.
Which I definitely want to go to the museum for sure. I would love to go to India. Absolutely. Yeah. But yeah, I think that getting people who can represent different sects of society in legislative bodies. That's what I was trying to say earlier. Getting those people in those legislative bodies so that they can make the appropriate social change using policy is super important. And he got us there.
Yeah.
Like he got butts in seats. he got the right people in the right seats to be able to make really good, effective change.
Totally.
And wrote a constitution that has changed many, many lives. He also did correspond with social rights leaders in the U.S.
He had talked to Martin Luther King, right? Like there was
At some point they had made contact. He did write W.E.B. Du Bois in the U.S. They did have contact.
Oh, that's right. Yeah.
Yeah. Who was also, a equality activist. And so he made contact with many different people throughout the world trying to make his own country better. And he's just a fascinating person and a fascinating life. His life to me exemplifies resilience and like using your intellect and commitment to inspire people and fight for social justice. He was a scholar and a leader and a reformer, and he left an indelible mark on India's socio-political landscape. And I just think he's just an incredible person. Again, only 60 years of life, but has affected hundreds of years after him. Yeah, some interesting things I found out about him. His teachings have really gained increased recognition after he passed away. So he's like sort of had a resurgence as an icon for different social justice movements in India. They established the Ambedkar Jayanti on April 14th as a public holiday in India to honor his birthday.
Nice.
He was also a Taurus.
Hey.
Various institutions, including universities and research centers, are named after him, no wonder, to commemorate his contributions. And in 1990, the Bharat Ratna, India's highest civilian award, was posthumously conferred on Ambedkar. He is also referred to by the very sweet nickname Baba Saheb, which means respected father.
Nice.
I watched a couple interviews about people talking about him when I was doing my research the other day. And just the way people talk about him, there's just such deep love.
Yeah, reverence. For
total reverence. So
I can imagine. I mean, the only person that was speaking on behalf of these people.
Yeah.
I mean, you talk about seeing your idols, you know, like literally a man who is a true rags to riches. I shouldn't even say riches, just...
Started from the bottom, now we're here.
Well, yeah, look, yeah. Like a rags to modest living story, you know, because he wasn't reaching for riches or fame or glory. He was just speaking on behalf of
equality
and his people.
And dismantling this terrible, old, antiquated system of believing that one human is over another.
Yeah.
It is a story that we tell ourselves, and it's incorrect, and we can tell a different story.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So I would ask you, I know you've been exposed to Dr. Ambedkar now through the movie as well, and then, you know, talking about his whole life today. What surprised you? What did you learn? What sticks out to you about Dr. Ambedkar's life?
I mean, I find, apart from the 50,000 personal books he owned, I think the fact that he climbed as high as he did, starting from the slums.
Yeah.
It's just incredible. In the movie, there's the visual of him getting poured water into his mouth at school.
Mm-hmm.
And then the other one where he's sitting in the back of the classroom, doesn't even have his own desk. He's on the floor, but he's working vigorously as a young kid.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that kind of tenacity and drive and ignoring what society has told you that you are.
Yeah.
You know, we've been talking a lot about identity lately because of this book, Atomic Habits, which everybody should read. I'm a huge fan right now. But in the book, they talk about in order to change, identity must be solidified.
Yeah.
Or at the very least, your identity must be identified in order for you to pursue who you want to be.
Mm-hmm.
And from the beginning, it sounded like he had this purpose in him.
Mm-hmm. He had a fire for sure. And he also just kept putting one foot in front of another. And to your point about identity, he might have been given an identity when he was born by society, but he did not let that identity hold him back. And he claimed a new one.
Totally.
He claimed a new identity. Yes, he was a Dalit, but he was also an educated and inspiring
academic,
scholar, lawyer, all these other identities. He claimed them. He did not hold himself back from them.
Yeah.
Because I do think that you always have the choice to listen to the identity someone gives you or choose your own.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
And he chose his own.
And he chose his own.
All the way to the end.
Yeah. What was Dr. Ambedkar's true north?
Cheering on the underdog. You know, in plainest terms, showing people that you can and everybody has a place where everybody has equal footing.
Yeah.
Equality. Purely as a human being.
Equality. We are equal to each other.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, absolutely. Here is to an incredible man, an incredible leader, and to living your life with such purpose that you affect thousands, millions after it. To Dr. Ambedkar.
Cheers.
Cheers.
That was a very well said toast.
Thank you.
Yeah.
I have a lot of love in my heart for this man. I really do. I think that
it is a really incredible story.
He seems like someone who was very intent and intentional.
Mm. Purposeful.
Purposeful. And just, I mean, the terrible, terrible, terrible things that Untouchables have had to go through in their lives and the history of their people. I have such hope because of him. And I think that that is what he brought to them and to all of us. There is hope for a different world.
Yeah.
A new world.
And I feel like we often forget to, when we're landlocked in our own country, in our own county, in our own state, blah, blah, blah. We always forget that these problems stem further outside of ourselves. Like, it is a universal problem that we belittle people and make people feel less than for the sake of our own humanity or lack thereof.
Or power.
Or power, especially. Because the caste system is exactly that. It's a fight for power and, you know, keeping people away from the things that you want to keep.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. It just breeds fear. It breeds more fear and it becomes a vicious cycle.
Yeah. It's a terrible thing. And there's a lot of really dark, heavy stuff going on in the world right now. And, I mean, they talk about in Origin that, you know, there are people throughout the world who suffer from hierarchy, just like is happening currently.
Every day. And it happens on small scales every day.
Yeah. And again, just, I know I said it earlier in the episode, but these are stories. They are just stories and we can tell a different narrative.
Totally.
And if we tell a different narrative, then other generations will listen and it will, the arc of history bends toward progress.
Yeah.
I think that is something that Dr. Martin Luther King said. So I'm going to glean to that.
Hey.
Would you like a trivia question?
Hey, hit me with it.
What extremely popular board game originated in India?
I don't know, but I'm very excited to find out. You know me, I'm a board game guy.
You are a big board game
guy. I'm a board game guy. Yeah. Going back to what we categorize ourselves as, big board game guy.
Big board game guy.
Yeah. Well, that's great. Thanks for sharing that.
Yeah.
Thanks, adventurers, for listening. Mm-hmm. If you have any opinions, thoughts, questions on Dr. Ambedkar, please email us at thepeoplesepic@gmail.com. Mm-hmm. Give us a follow in the show notes. We linked our Instagram there, so give us a shout out on the Insta. Hope you have a great rest of your week. I'll be back next week with the adventurer, and we'll find out what this board game is.
We will. We'll find out what the board game is. I believe Origin will still be in theaters once
this drops. Check it out.
Go check it out. I hope I did Dr. Ambedkar's story justice. And
I think you did.
Yeah.
Yeah. Until next time. What? Go ahead. What are you going to say?
I was just going to say, be kind to each other.
Be kind to each other. Until next time, here's your true north.
Cheers.
Bye. Bye.